Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll return to a topic that we have discussed many times on this program, and that is the politics of the Middle East. And our guest is someone who has many years' experience of service as a diplomat in Jordan. His name is Marwan Mwasher. He is a senator, was a senator in the Jordanian parliament, and also served in a number of high-level posts, including the deputy prime minister in charge of reform. He also served as foreign minister, as Jordan's ambassador to the United States. He also served as minister of information. He was the first ambassador of Jordan to Israel and also was a spokesman to the Middle East peace talks. This was between 1991 and 1994. And we will talk about some of what you will find in his book, The Arab Center. The subtitle of the book is The Promise of Moderation. This book is published by the Yale University Press. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore. And in the book, he makes the argument that while it may seem that today Arab citizens have two choices politically, either to support ruling elites who have failed to bring development and freedom to their people, or to support religious parties that threaten regional stability, he says, in fact, there can be a third choice, reformed governments that tolerate diversity and that actively seek peace. More on this as we talk in this part of Focus 580. Questions, of course, from people who are listening are welcome. All we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments and questions brief so we can get in as many people as possible and keep the program moving along. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. 333-9455, that is the number for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, you certainly are welcome to join in the conversation. Dr. Mwasher, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And it's just as to something I want to mention here at the beginning. I understand that you actually spent some time in our part of the world. You were at Purdue.
Yes, I was. I actually got my senior year at Purdue as well as my master's and PhD. So I consider the Midwest a second home.
Ah, well, I'm pleased to have you talking with us this morning.
Thank you.
It seems to me, I think that perhaps if you look at what is written about the politics in the Middle East, certainly what we see in much of our media here in the United States, it would make it difficult to believe that there was a center, because so much of the coverage seems to be indeed about the conflict between current regimes, often autocratic and non-democratic regimes, and their opponents that are increasingly militant Islamist parties. Talk with us a little bit about the center and what really you mean when you say that there is in fact a possibility of a third way here.
In fact, I chose the book's title carefully, the Arab Center, precisely because of your point. Indeed, the Western notion is that there are no moderates in our area, that the Arab world is a bunch of fanatics. And what I aim to prove through first-hand accounts in the book is that on the peace process, there was a very, and still is, a very proactive Arab Center, Arab moderate forces that have put on the table initiatives in the last decade. In fact, all the initiatives on the peace process came from that center to try to peacefully end the Arab-Israeli conflict. At the same time, I also make the argument that you refer to, which is that that center has focused its attention only on the peace process and has not addressed issues of concern to Arabs as well, such as political reform, economic well-being, good governance, and cultural diversity. And because this center has not been able, despite its valiant efforts, to solve the peace process, and certainly has not addressed the other issues, it is losing credibility fast.
Well, how do you confront a government, and I don't want to name any specific governments, but there are, throughout the Arab world, governments that are not interested in allowing any kind of political opposition. Certainly, they're not interested in a political opposition that comes from Islamist parties, but it seems as if they're also not interested in allowing any kind of even moderate opposition. They don't want to have any kind of opposition at all.
Well, there are indeed two schools of thought in the Arab world today. One is the traditional school of thought, which argues that if you open up the system, the Islamists come in, and therefore you need to keep it closed. And the other school that points out that keeping the system closed, which was the status quo position for the last 40 years, has not in fact weakened Islamists or radical religious ideologies, but has in fact strengthened them precisely because of the lack of a system of checks and balances, and therefore people are flocking to those who think will promise them cleaner government. And the other school of thought is arguing that if you don't open up the system, the Islamists will come in, and that the only way that Arab governments can really, Arab moderate governments can really thrive is by sharing their power and opening up the system gradually.
Well, do you think it is the case that the criticism that is sometimes made of Arab governments, this criticism that says, because you have stifled any kind of opposition at all, including the possibility of a more moderate progressive opposition, that you have actually strengthened the hand or created the conditions for the rise of significant Islamist parties that are now posing perhaps an even greater challenge than any kind of more moderate opposition would have in the past?
I certainly subscribe to this. I don't think that the choice of a radical religious ideology that threatens the political and cultural diversity of society is a comfortable choice. I also equally don't think that the choice of a ruling elite which is not checked by any system of checks and balances and which is becoming increasingly non-transparent is also a comfortable option. If you look at what happened in the West Bank and Gaza in 2006, people opted to bring in a radical religious power force to power, Hamas, not necessarily because they subscribe to their radical ideologies against peace, but because they promised them cleaner government, and because the Palestinian National Authority at the time was not able to deliver on the peace process, even though it tried. And this is basically my argument. We can continue to try, and we need to try, to bring in a peaceful settlement to the Arab-Israeli conflict, but we cannot make it our only sort of raison d'etre.
Well, having said that, though, how, if it was, if it were possible to settle that conflict, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, what would that mean for the politics of the Middle East as a whole?
Well, one, it will remove a great cause of frustration, which the radical forces are using to their benefit. Two, it would show that the moderate policies of the Arab Center are working, and that indeed by calling for a peaceful coexistence and achieving that peaceful coexistence, they deserve to be heard. Without a resolution of this conflict, the frustration that is only growing in the region is only feeding into those who do not want a peaceful settlement on both sides.
Do you, here in the West, I think that we have a commitment to the idea of secular government. And it is something that people in the Middle East, I think, I'm not sure that they understand, or perhaps they would just say, well, we have a different idea. That is that they see that there is no way to separate religious values from political values, and for that reason, they would argue that the idea of separation of church and state, as we like to talk about it, simply doesn't make sense. They would say that their religious values are going to inform everything they do, and that for that reason, they would expect that they would inform government as well as other areas of life. Is that something? Do you think that perhaps people in the Arab Center and perhaps people in the West are simply going to have to accept and learn how to talk with people who have that kind of orientation toward religious values and political values?
Religious values in our region is certainly a factor and translate themselves differently maybe than in the West. And the idea of a total separation of church and state is an idea that, has not had or grown any roots in the area. However, what I also want to say is that secularism in our region is often confused with atheism. So the idea of a separation of church and state in our region is thought of, looked at as an idea to, bring people away from God and religion, which is absolutely not the case. And secularists have a responsibility to explain that they are not against religion. They are simply against having religion play, too strong of a role in state matters.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Mar Juan Washer. He is someone who has a lot of experience serving in government as a diplomat in Jordan. He was the deputy prime minister in charge of reform, his most recent position. He's also served as the foreign minister, as the minister of information. He was the ambassador to the United States. He was the first ambassador of Jordan to Israel. Also was a spokesman for the Middle East peace talks between 1991 and 1994. He sets down some of his ideas about the politics of the region in his book, The Arab Center. The subtitle is The Promise of Moderation. The book is published by the Yale University Press. He's talking with us this morning by telephone, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You have said that you felt that perhaps too, I don't know if it's correct to say too much, but you said it would not be good to focus exclusively on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to the exclusion of other sorts of issues that you would say people should deal with. But having said that, as someone who has been an observer of the peace process for some time now, and I realize this is a large question, why do you feel that to date more progress has not been made?
Well, the Arab-Israeli conflict has been with us for the last 60 years, and whereas I certainly understand that at the beginning, people wanted to solve this conflict and maybe did not focus much of their energies and efforts on other issues, we simply, in the 21st century, cannot just wait for the Arab-Israeli conflict to be solved before we deal with our other issues. That's what I'm saying. I still believe very strongly that the Arab-Israeli conflict is at the center of the radar screen of the Arab world. That is, in fact, a major source of frustration and conflict. It is not the only source, however. And in the 21st century, we need to start building seriously a system of checks and balances and a system of political pluralism and political parties. And whereas certain Arab countries made some strides towards that, we simply do not have any Arab country which has consistently followed a political reform process today. I have been part of government. I have pushed for that when I was in government, and I think that this is something that Arab moderates need to continue to push for. If Arab moderates are only moderates on peace and are not moderates on reform, they simply will not have the credibility that they need.
Hmm. Well, just for a moment to stay with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I think sometimes we talk as if outside parties, either other Arab governments or the government of the United States or governments of European countries, should have some influence or should be able to assist in the talks between the two sides. And certainly there have been repeated attempts to do that over the years. Do you think, though, that in fact that is the case, that any outside party, the United States or Jordan or Egypt or the Saudis or anyone else, actually is in a position to nudge the two sides together, or whether, in fact, what we're really talking about here is something that ultimately has to be solved by the Palestinians and the Israelis, and it's not something that outsiders can really help with?
I think history will show you that outsiders have helped, in fact, and that without the help of outsiders, very few agreements have been reached. If you look at Camp David and the Carter administration, Egypt and Israel would not have signed a peace treaty without the active participation of the United States. Not to tell the parties what their positions should be, but to serve as guarantors of the peace process. Today, Israel feels that without the United States as a guarantor of its security, it might not be able to provide the compromises that are necessary for a viable solution. Today, the Palestinians also feel that without the umbrella of the Arab world supporting them, they might also not be able to give compromises on certain key issues. In fact, the Arab Peace Initiative that all Arab states signed to in 2002 did exactly that. It promised Israel a collective peace treaty with the Arab world, a collective security guarantees for Israel, so that it gives Israel the comfort space it needs to give the Palestinians a viable state and end the conflict.
Mm. And is that something that, do you think that part of the problem is here, is the Israelis simply don't believe that?
They do. I think that the Israelis have postponed looking into the mirror, frankly, as far as reaching a peaceful settlement. Today, Israel faces a huge demographic problem. Today, it rules over 3.5 to 4 million Palestinians. Very soon, the number of Palestinians will be larger than the number of Israelis inside Israel. And unless we arrive at a two-state solution, Israel is going to be faced with a very, very stark choices. So my argument is that a two-state solution today is not just in the interest of the Arab world and those of the Palestinians, but also in the interest of Israel. Now, the Israelis themselves are coming to that realization. Rabin came to it in the mid-90s and signed an agreement with the Palestinians and tried to work towards a Palestinian state. Olmert and Sharon belatedly came to it at the beginning of this decade. But there is no question today that the two-state solution is the only solution that will meet the interests of both sides.
Hmm. Well, you said a little bit earlier that while there are Arab governments that perhaps have made some progress toward reform, that it's been limited all around, and perhaps no one has come close to what you would like to see, what you would believe could be. Where would you say the most progress had been made? Is there some place that you would point to say this is a model, imperfect perhaps, but shows what might happen, what could happen, in the direction in which we should be moving?
Well, if you look at the different Arab states, I can point to Morocco and say that Morocco, in the area of family law and the area of women rights, have done rather well. Tunisia also. Jordan has been a model in terms of women rights. If you look at political diversity and the evolution of a political party system, then it is difficult to point to any other Arab country and say they have made very important strides. We have political parties in Jordan. Morocco has political parties. They exist in different parts of the Arab world, but nowhere in the Arab world is the political party system developed to a degree where it can provide a system of checks and balances which guarantees the rule of law. This is where we need to evolve and have a serious commitment to.
Mm-hmm. Well, and how does that happen? What would be the conditions under which that would happen?
I think you need two basic conditions that everybody must adhere to. One is that political parties must adhere to peaceful means. So you don't have any political party that carry arms, such as Hezbollah in Lebanon or Hamas in the West Bank. And two, all political parties should also adhere to the principle of, or to the commitment of, political and cultural diversity, meaning that you don't use democracy to come to power once and then deny it to others, such as what has happened with the Iranian system. If these two principles are adhered to, I think that they should constitute a very solid basis on which everybody should move with comfort, knowing that diversity will always be a principal pillar of the system.
Well, how do you go about convincing people that is a good idea, that diversity is a good idea, that pluralism is a good idea, that once you've managed to achieve power, that then you have to be willing to be open to the possibility that then someone's going to come along and there'll be an election and suddenly you'll find yourself not in power anymore. That's something that people in this region are not used to.
Exactly, and this is why you cannot do it overnight. It has to be done gradually. It has to be, these principles have to be enshrined in the constitutions of each Arab country, and then the application, the implementation of them has to be done over a number of years. I'm not a proponent of opening up a system without these controls to make sure that we indeed move towards diversity at all times. But the alternative that some people are advocating of no movement at all concerned that any movement would bring the Islamists to power, I think is not sustainable. Today, no movement means a strengthening of the radical forces, as we are seeing each day. Who have even heard of parties like Hamas or Hezbollah 20 years ago? They did not even exist. The fact that they exist today is a symbol of the frustration that people feel because of the closed systems that they are under.
Mm-hmm. I suppose some people would argue that the fact that there are so many people supporting these parties is a result of their feeling that they really have no choice. That is, either they support the government or that by supporting these kinds of reform Islamist parties, that's the best chance for change. And you might argue that if people were actually given another choice, they might support that choice, something that was a more sort of occupied the middle ground. That could it well be that, though, that one reason why people support Islamist parties, maybe indeed support parties like Hezbollah and Hamas, is because they actually support the agenda of those parties, and it's not simply a matter that it's that or nothing, or it's that or the government, but that people are actually supporting these parties because they agree with the positions those parties have taken.
Precisely. I mean, you have said it extremely well. If people want a protest vote, if they do not want to vote for a government which, in their view, might not be transparent, might be corrupt, etc., the only alternative that exists for them today is the religious parties. We don't have third and fourth choices, and that was exactly my point, that governments have an interest in opening up the system and allowing people to have third and fourth choices so that these are not the only two alternatives available to people. That is the central theme of the book, and I, through first-hand accounts, as I said, because I have been involved both in the process of reform and in the process of the peace process in the Arab world, that is the principal argument I make. I mean, today the center is very much on the defensive in the Arab world and very much diminishing in the Arab world because that center has not been able to provide answers for any of these issues.
And I would expect that people in the center would find themselves pressed from both sides as well, both from the established governments and also from the particularly what we're talking about here, religious based parties, Islamist opposition parties who are on the other side, and here the people in the middle find themselves in the middle facing pressure from both sides.
Absolutely. The center today is looked at as almost a traitor on issues regarding peace by the Islamist parties because it's a center that is looked at as a compromiser of Arab rights, as apologist for the West, etc. And if that center is also calling for reform, it is looked at suspiciously by Arab governments and the ruling elite. In fact, the ruling elite, the traditional establishment, if you will, might even have a functional alliance with the Islamists against reform, but for different reasons. But my argument is that the center needs to win people's hearts and minds, and it can do this if it is at peace with itself and if it advocates consistent policies on all fronts, not on one front again alone. You cannot be a moderate on peace, but not be a moderate on diversity. Hmm. It doesn't work.
We are at our midpoint. Actually, we're a little bit past the midpoint of this hour of Focus 580, talking with Marwan Mashour. He has served in a number of high-level posts in the diplomatic service of Jordan. He was the ambassador to the United States. He served as the first ambassador to Israel. He's also been the deputy prime minister in charge of reform. He served as foreign minister, as minister of information, and also as spokesman to the Middle East peace talks from in the period between 1991 and 1994. He sets out some of his ideas about the politics of the region in his book, The Arab Center. The subtitle is The Promise of Moderation. The book is published by the Yale University Press. Certainly you can find it in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. Questions are welcome as well here in Champaign-Urbana if you'd like to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. What sort of problems do you think, let us say, you said that maybe part of the problem here is that there has been so much concentration on the peace question, on the Arab-Israeli, the Arab-Palestinian conflict, so much concentration on that other equally important issues haven't gotten the amount of attention that they should. And here, certainly, we have a number of Arab governments here are confronted with serious challenges, internal challenges. There are questions about the future of their countries, about their economies. Many of these countries have large numbers of young people who want to have a future. They want to have good jobs. They want to have families. They want to prosper and feel that those opportunities in many cases aren't there for them. What would you say would be the most significant issues that Arab governments, aside from the big one, what are some of the most important issues you think that Arab governments have to confront?
Well, one major area that I feel needs to have serious attention is the quality of education in the Arab world. And I say quality, not quantity, because the Arab world has done a lot in terms of putting people in school, both men and women, in building schools and in eradicating illiteracy. But we have not done enough in terms of the quality of education so that we indeed equip people with the skills needed for the marketplace. As you have said, 60% of the Arab world is under 30 years of age. This is what is called the youth bulge, which means that there are huge numbers of people attempting to enter the workforce each year, but don't have the necessary skills to do so. Why? Because the quality of education is still an outdated educational system that does not emphasize critical thinking, that does not emphasize problem-solving methods, that does not emphasize the soft skills that are needed for these people to enter the workforce. And if there is any one thing that the Arab world must do and must do soon is to address this quality of education issue in a very serious manner. It has implications that extend to job creation, to women's empowerment, to good governance, to all of the other issues facing the Arab world today.
And if that is not happening, is that because Arab governments don't have the resources to put into the education system, or they're choosing to put their resources somewhere else?
It's probably both. It's probably both. Certainly the continuation of the Arab-Israeli conflict has meant that a lot of resources needed elsewhere have gone to that conflict. But certainly also, I think Arab governments need to open up the system, and maybe there is a concern that if you start, teaching people critical thinking methods, etc., that this might work against Arab governments. My argument is that this is a necessary condition for the development of the Arab world. The Arab world is starting to lag behind almost every region in the world as far as democracy is concerned, as far as certain issues such as women's empowerment are concerned. And if we are to catch up with the rest of the world, we cannot ignore these issues any longer.
Certainly, one wouldn't want to understate just how difficult settling the Israeli-Palestinian conflict would be, and any other problems, political problems in the region. At the same time, it seems that you could make the argument that says, if this conflict could be settled, and we deal with that issue and perhaps some others, that then we could channel our energies into making this region more prosperous. That you could make an argument that peace would be good for prosperity. Peace would be good for economic development. And that if we could put the other stuff aside, then that ultimately that would be good for everyone, and it would result in increased standard of living, not just for a few people, but for everyone.
There's no question that resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict is going to mean a rechanneling of resources into development, is going to mean a better integration of the region, in better trade amongst the region, etc. There is no question that this is going to be the case. At the same time, what I'm also saying is we cannot afford to wait until the conflict ends before we start addressing some of these other issues. We have waited for 60 years with disastrous results on development in the Arab world. And so the two processes must go in parallel.
Well, do you think that it is the case that this is perhaps complicated by relations between the various Arab governments? That is, ostensibly they're all friends, and we talk about them as if this is some sort of a monolithic entity, the Arab world or the Middle East, apart from Israel. But what could you say about relations between the various governments? And in fact, is that sometimes a problem?
Of course, it is. The Arab world is certainly not monolithic. And in fact, what I also try to show in the book is that the different positions of different Arab countries, those that can be counted among the radicals and those that can be counted among the moderates. And through that, I try to explain to the Western reader how different Arab governments think, because they certainly don't think alike. I think one other thing that I also attempt to explain is the different Islamic groups in the Arab and Muslim world, because also political Islam in this country is often seen as monolithic. Mm-hmm. While I talk about at least three different groups in political Islam. One, the exclusionist types, those that are at war with the whole world, those that do not believe in compromise, those that are not just against the West but are against other Muslim groups and such as Al-Qaeda. These people you cannot deal with, you cannot negotiate with, because they're not interested in dialogue and negotiation. But then you have two other different groups. One, the second group is a group of political Islamist forces that have evolved because of the occupation of their countries, such as in Lebanon and in Palestine, that is Hezbollah and Hamas. Groups who have employed violent radical means, who have carried arms and are still carrying arms, but who are increasingly now entering the political system in both Lebanon and the West Bank and Gaza through parliament. And then you have a third group, which is the peaceful Islamist groups, who have always been peaceful, who have never carried arms, who have always been part of the political process in their countries, such as the Muslim Brotherhood in Jordan or the Islamic Party in Morocco. And I argue that you need to deal differently with each group. You need to encourage the second group to give up its arms and enter the political process peacefully, such as the third group, so migrate to the third group, while you fight the first group with which there is no compromise.
Hmm. Well, one piece of the third group, the peaceful Islamists, and you mentioned the Muslim Brotherhood, that brings to mind the case of Egypt, where here we have a government that has been in place for a long period of time. Hosni Mubarak has now been in power longer than Anwar Sadat and Nasser put together, and seems to be grooming his son to take over. They're the strongest opposition, political opposition group to the ruling party is the Muslim Brotherhood that is officially banned. And in fact, what Egypt has done is made it illegal to have a religious-based party, essentially quashing all possibility of opposition. And then this is something that, for example, here in the United States, that might be in a position to have some leverage to talk with the government of Egypt and to Mr. Mubarak about what might be more progressive, has essentially said nothing at all about internally Egyptian politics. Apparently, we consider that Egypt is an important enough ally, so we're not going to at least publicly criticize them. Is there, for example, something that the United States could do in this particular case that would move things in more in the direction you would like to see them go?
Well, let me say first that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and Jordan, I think, offer a very clear example of what happened when you deal with them differently. In Egypt, where they were banned, they chose to carry arms and work underground. Whereas in Jordan, where they were not banned and have always been part of the political process, they have always been peaceful. And this just adds to my argument that you need to follow an inclusionist policy as long as people are peaceful and pursue their objectives through peaceful means. Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I'm sorry. The other part of your question, if you can remind me, David, of it.
Well, I'm just wondering.
Yes.
You know, and perhaps
on the United States and helping democracy.
Yes.
Look, in all frankness, the policies of the last 7 years of the United States administration has not helped, because now, when the United States today calls for democracy in the Middle East, people look at what happened with the war in Iraq and are skeptical. Often any support for Democrats by the United States in the Arab world is a kiss of death. On one hand, I think it is the responsibility of Arabs themselves to sort of carry the torch. I think you need to raise this issue at all times. But I also think that the credibility of the United States, particularly in the last 7 years, has not helped the cause of Democrats in the region.
Mm. The other set of groups here, obviously the first that you mentioned, the exclusionist groups and groups like Al-Qaeda, for example, one can't imagine the United States sitting down with them, and perhaps there would be no point to do so. But here in the middle, we have two groups that the United States has said that it will not talk with, has labeled as terrorists, Hamas and Hezbollah. Can you here imagine some situation under which the United States, perhaps not the current administration, but a future administration, would say, well, under a certain set of circumstances, we actually could imagine sitting down and talking with representatives of these groups? And in fact, would you say that that's something that really needs to happen?
I think so. I think dialogue is important. I think that as long as people are open to dialogue and are open to compromise, that you need to reach an agreement with them. Not to compromise, your own principles, and certainly, as I said, I am one that also do not believe in them carrying arms and employing radical tactics to solve their problems. There must be a peaceful resolution to the Arab-Israeli conflict. But to reach that, it seems to me you need to have a dialogue with those, not just with those that agree with you on peace, but those who don't. You have done this with the IRA in Ireland, and I think it can also be done with Hezbollah and Hamas.
Just again to introduce our guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last 10 or 15 minutes, Marwan Mouachour. He is a Jordanian diplomat. He has served as the ambassador from Jordan to the United States. He was also the first ambassador of Jordan to Israel. In addition, he has served as deputy prime minister in charge of reform in Jordan, also the foreign minister, and also minister of information. He sets out his ideas about the politics in the Middle East in a recently published book, which is titled The Arab Center. The subtitle is The Promise of Moderation, and it's published by the Yale University Press. Certainly questions are welcome from people who are listening. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I realize that we keep returning to this point, but it seems to me that it is one of the more difficult aspects here, and that is how it is that you manage to persuade a government that has essentially made it impossible for anyone to challenge it, to make a significant legitimate challenge, to open up the system so that there is the possibility for an opposition party not only to challenge a ruling government, but actually to unseat a ruling government. It seems that such a long way from where we are now to that point. I realize you said that it was not something that can happen quickly. It's not going to happen overnight. But it seems almost impossible for me to imagine even an incremental kind of movement in that sort of direction, given just how adamant so many of these governments have been about not allowing any kind of political opposition.
Well, I think the best argument that anyone can put forward is governments are faced with two choices: either peaceful, moderate opposition or violent, radical opposition. And if you don't open up the system, then the only alternative is a radical opposition, which is getting strengthened by the day. And so, in my mind, it is clear that this is the best argument that you can put forward. I realize the irony and of telling a government to open up so that in the end it might not hold to power. What I'm saying is, in the end, if the system is kept closed, then that government is not going to hold to power anyway, except that the alternative that it will be faced with is a radical violent opposition, and that is something that nobody wants in our region, and certainly not here as well.
It seems that there are a number of governments that so far feel that they've managed to deal with radical militant opposition by force, and perhaps they feel that they can continue to do that.
That's certainly the case, David, and I'm sure that many countries and governments believe that, but history tells you otherwise. There is no way that you can keep people by force forever. The best way is to open up systems, is to allow people political space, is to allow people a voice. And unless you do that, you're just perpetuating an artificial situation that might blow up against you at any time.
We have about 5 minutes, perhaps a little bit more in this hour of the show. We do have a caller here we'll get to. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The caller here is on a cell phone, so we'll talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. How you doing?
Yes.
I've been listening for a while, and I've been really enjoying listening to the conversation, mostly for the reason that I am interested in learning about the Middle East and its conflicts and possible resolutions. I mean, it's something our country has chosen to become embroiled in. And as I'm listening, I want to see if I understand the direction it's coming from. The position is about using moderation to solve political problems. Our country has, over history, wrestled with its own narrative of issues of conservatism versus progressivism. It's dealt with religion, sexism, racism. Within the Middle East, there has been its own host of issues it's wrestled with, whether it be emplaced and challenging religious political groups such as Sunnis and Shias and Kurds in certain areas, more established monarchies. Now, also within there is a few other recent 20th century issues, such as the creation of an Israeli state, also the interventions of the United States, for example, in the 50s in Iran, and backing certain political bodies. And I understand that a lot of the political problems arising today that the United States of America faces with the Middle East arise from trying to resolve some of these issues. And I'm curious how you think resolution is possible with moderation, because it seems that within our own country, the extreme sides are where the battle lines are drawn, and the moderates are the ones that present themselves as being the only ones that can cross the aisle, that can work across party lines, that can create some kind of resolution. And with the news that we have, all we really hear about are the extremists. So I'm curious what you think moderation has to offer with resolving political issues in the Middle East. Thank you.
Well, moderation, I guess, might be seen differently in the United States than in our region. Here, whether people belong to the Republican Party, to the extreme right of the Republican Party, or the extreme left of the Democratic Party, they do so within a system that is peaceful, that calls for a peaceful rotation of power, and that does so in a very structured manner, where you have a system of checks and balances, where you have different legislative, executive, and judicial authorities, so that no one authority, you know, is overly powerful over others. This is what I mean by moderation in the Arab world, a force that calls for political and cultural diversity and believes in that diversity, implements it, as well as implements coexistence in our region between Arabs and Israelis. We cannot, you know, have exclusionist dreams anymore. We cannot have both sides have a story to tell that ignores the other side completely. If we do that, we will never achieve peace in our region. And this is the kind of moderation that I call for, and a proactive form of moderation, not passive moderation that just sits and takes whatever comes its way, but a kind of moderation that works for a political and cultural diversity.
I'm sure that that you understand that here in the United States, that there are, in as much as there are important disagreements between Democrats and Republicans, there are some people who would argue that there is not a great deal of difference between the two parties. I'm sure that here in the part of the world that we're talking about, the gulf between, let us say, militant Islamist, or maybe I shouldn't use the word militant, Islamist parties, religiously based political parties, the gulf between them and established governments is very great. And it seems to me that this would be a significant challenge for someone who would consider himself to be a moderate somewhere in the middle and would think about trying to be a bridge between the two sides. It seems that in this case, the two sides are much further apart than for example, the ends of the spectrum, or most people here in the United States, if you look at that.
Well, that is certainly true. In fact, what I'm trying to do is not maybe act as a bridge between the two as much as offer people third and fourth alternatives. Mm-hmm. I might not be able to change the views of radical Islamist parties. What I think we should be able to do is to present people with alternatives to the two choices that they presently have, and in doing so, you know, strengthen a core centrist moderate force.
Well, we're at the point where we have maybe a minute or two left. We've talked about a lot of things here, and obviously the problems that we've talked about are difficult, and in this context changes, if indeed it does occur, it's going to be slow. Do you manage to find some cause for optimism about or optimism for change in the direction that you're advocating?
Yes, I think that increasingly you are seeing forces in the Arab world that are not satisfied with the status quo and that are pushing for change, and they are certainly not a majority today. but they are certainly increasing, and the radicalization that is happening in the region at an alarming rate is helping strengthen the moderate but so far maybe not so vocal forces. I think these are becoming more vocal by the day.
Just I apologize for introducing a different subject, but I'm interested in your view of Iran and whether or not you think that if for the Arab governments of this region, the rise of Iran, the possibility that Iran is gaining in power and stature, is that a problem? Do governments consider that Iran to be any kind of a threat, and does that help to pull governments together? Does the power of Iran, the prominence of Iran, give Arab governments some kind of rallying point, something that they can say, well, at least here's one thing that we have in common?
Well, Iran poses a problem in the region in two aspects. First, it has also supported the radicals as far as the peace process is concerned. But also, this nuclear capability or potential nuclear capability might open up the door for a nuclear arms race in the Middle East, which is not in the interest of everyone. We have always been against Israel having nuclear power for the same reason. So in that sense, I think that it is important that an agreement is reached with Iran. Having said that, I think that it would be very catastrophic if there is a military option exercised. We've had enough problems in the region, and we don't need another major one that might, be more than the order of the Iraq war. I think that if the position of the United States is to solve this diplomatically, then it would seem to me that this must be done through dialogue.
Well, we'll have to close at this point again with our thanks to our guest, Marwan Moshir. He served as a senator in the Parliament of Jordan and also one of Jordan's top diplomats. He has served as deputy prime minister in charge of reform, as foreign minister, as ambassador to the United States, and also the first ambassador to Israel. More of his ideas about the region can be found in his book, The Arab Center, The Promise of Moderation. It's published by the Yale University Press. And Dr. Moshir, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.